This is White Collared, the podcast. Season 2, Episode 17, bonus episode, The Real Crimes of White Collar. Thank you for joining me for this special bonus episode of White Collared, the podcast, which of course is a retrospective commentary on the USA Network television series White Collar. My name is Eric Alton Glenn Hilliard. Now, this is a bonus episode. It is not a commentary on a specific episode. However, it is tied to Season 2, Episode 3, Copycat Caffrey. If you recall, in that episode, Professor George Oswald was using his students to copycat famous crimes by famous criminals, one of which was our hero, Neil Caffrey. However, there were two other criminals specifically mentioned that were real criminals and committed real crimes that were referenced either directly or indirectly in the episode. And today that's what we're going to discuss, are those two criminals and those two sets of crimes. Because both of them are Neil Caffrey-like and Neil Caffrey-worthy. The first we're going to talk about is Jonathan Tokley Perry. Like Neil Caffrey, there's not a lot of objective third-party information about the man himself. Most of the personal information that is available seems to come from him. And most of the articles that I found about him and about his crime are pretty much word-for-word reposts of other articles. So, not a lot of information out there, but here's what I was able to glean about him. Born into a middle-class British family, Jonathan Tokley Perry was accepted into Cambridge University, where he received a philosophy degree in ethics. Ethics? Question mark. And later a doctorate in London from University College. It was while at Cambridge that he developed his interest in art and antiquities. Tokley Perry describes himself as a former cavalryman, but when he attempted to join the army, he was turned down. So he had to settle for joining the Territorial Army, somewhat equivalent to the reserves here in the U.S. He also trained as an antiques restorer, reportedly becoming one of the best in the estimation of some, although I was unable to find any indication as to where he trained as a restorer or who he studied under. Now, according to Tokley Perry, once he had restored an antiquity piece, the requirement that he return it to the original owner kind of made him feel like a servant. I imagine he was a very well-paid servant. But nonetheless, his attitude was he was being treated like a servant, he felt like a servant, but he didn't like being a servant, so he wanted to be the master and own the antiquities, not merely restore them for someone else. Although arguably it was just that he saw an opportunity to make a fortune by being an antiques dealer and not merely a restorer. In the early 1990s, Tokley Perry went to Egypt under the guise of being a researcher, and he met a local smuggler who led him to a site uncovered by a local contractor who had connections to smuggling and smugglers. There at that site, he was shown an artifact. It was a carved stone head of Amenhotep III, and Tokley Perry purchased it for $6,000 cash. But at this time, the Gulf War was raging, and the Egyptian authorities were arresting foreigners who were merely seen with Egyptians. No telling what they would have done to someone who was a suspected smuggler. Perhaps, as Tokley Perry later suggested, he might well have been taken on a one-way trip to an isolated spot in the desert and not come back. His solution to getting the piece out of Egypt was a technique that would actually serve him throughout his career as a smuggler, and that was to make a genuine artifact look to be a cheap tourist souvenir. He coated the head with a protective layer of plastic-type material, then built up a cover layer that made the piece appear to be a modern, mass-produced casting, the sort of thing that, as he puts it, idiots buy in hotel shops all the time. Now, he covered the new outer layer with gold leaf and then painted it with crude markings. He then purchased a genuine souvenir bust, which gave him a sales receipt, and a base onto which he could mount the genuine artifact in place of the souvenir bust. The result is, in his own words, an object that is absolutely ghastly, the sort of thing that no one would look at twice. Except that at the airport, as he was preparing to leave, the antiquities police wanted to see inside the suitcase he had with him. He opened the case and showed the officer the bust and the sales receipt, explaining that it was a present for someone. But then the officer pulled out his keys. He was going to check the bust by scratching the surface, checking for something revealing under the paint. The problem for Tokelauppeura was that the face was mostly original stone, with small sections filled in and completed in plaster and covered with paint. If the officer scratched on the face, it would immediately reveal the true artifact. But, having foreseen such a possibility, Tokelauppeura had extended the neck of the bust, adding about an inch of plaster at the bottom, extending the bust by that length, and then he persuaded the officer not to scratch the face. Apparently, he appealed to him by suggesting that scratching the face would mar the present that he had purchased for someone, and directed the officer to that specially prepared portion of the bust. Well, the misdirection worked. The officer saw plaster underneath the paint and let Tokelauppeura pass. After passing through customs on entering England, he set about to remove the built-up plaster encasement. He soaked it in acetone, which slowly removed all the alterations he had made to hide the piece and left him a fully intact artifact. But the next problem was to sell it to a collector without it being recognized as a stolen artifact. He used his skills as a restorer to restore the piece, adding a portion of beard, changing other elements slightly, and just enough to disguise the piece. Then he set about creating the documentation to give his restored piece legitimacy. Taking turn-of-the-century pharmaceutical labels, he cut individual letters from them and used them to create an identification seal for a fictitious Thomas Alcock collection, Thomas Alcock being Tokelauppeura's great uncle. He then had the identification seal printed on old paper stock and used chemically faded ink to add hand-printed identifying details as would be appropriate for an old-style identification label. So you had this label that was printed, and then by hand you wrote in the details, the name, the reference number in your catalog for that piece, whatever information you were going to write in by hand. So that's what he did using that faded old ink. And then he took the label, cut it out, and aged it by soaking it in tea, drying it, wetting it, drying it again, repeating the process until he had a label that looked old and worn. He then glued the label onto the back of the sculpture. The result was a piece that looked like it had come from an old private collection in England. Using his contacts from within the collector's world, he put the piece up for sale, and it fetched $1 million. Tokelauppeura was off on a smuggling operation that continued for years. Over the course of time, his deceptions took on a bit more flair, once even painting Made in Egypt on a statue's base. One time, he had an accomplice create a false invoice for a statue, which was allegedly being sent out for restoration. Then he conned a Hollywood prosthesis maker into creating a copy of it and other looted antiquities for return to Egypt and registration. So the fakes were sent back and registered as artifacts. At least that's as I understand it. But as his success increased, so did his taste for the extravagant lifestyle. Expensive handmade suits, expensive cars, and so many artifacts in Egypt that he had secured that he realized he needed help to keep growing the operation. He hired Mark Perry, a local handyman, to be his mule, with the promise of £500 a week, travel, fancy hotels, and adventure, and Andrew May, who was a threadbare aristocrat, to manage the negotiations for the purchase of additional artifacts. Unfortunately, May didn't stick with the program. So instead of just buying pieces for Tokelauppeura, he also set himself up to buy and smuggle pieces out for himself, thus cutting Tokelauppeura out of a portion of the things that he actually did, even though Tokelauppeura was footing the bill for them. Unfortunately for Tokelauppeura and for May, May didn't have the expertise that he needed to pull off these cons and these thefts. May had purchased 27 papyrus documents, but concerned that he had been sold fakes, he took them to the British Museum to be authenticated. Unfortunately for him, the curators at the museum quickly recognized the papyri because they were artifacts that they themselves had originally discovered and which were stolen soon after their discovery. Museum officials contacted the police, who concluded that since taking the papyri to the British Museum was probably one of the dumbest things that anybody could have done, May couldn't have been the brains behind the operation. Investigations into May revealed that Tokelauppeura was a tenant at a large manor house owned by May, and given Tokelauppeura's position as a restorer and the fact that he was owner of a large collection of Egyptian pieces, suspicion began to focus on him. Now, simultaneous to May being investigated, Mark Perry had come into the notice of authorities as well. He had been making large cash deposits into bank accounts and initially was thought to be involved in the drug trade, but further investigations revealed his frequent trips to Egypt. Eventually, the various investigative agencies involved in the various investigations, whether it be drug or counterfeits or whatever, they got together and made a tentative connection between Mark Perry and Tokley Perry. Local police and detectives from Scotland Yard executed multiple search warrants, including at the manor house where Tokley Perry's workshop was discovered, and there they found a hoard of antiques, including a pair of false doors from the tomb of Hetepka, a royal hairdresser. Now, the tomb near Cairo had been plundered in 1991 while Tokley Perry was in Egypt. Imagine that. Additional forgeries and incriminating files and photographs were found. Many of the photographs included Tokley Perry posing with stolen artifacts. Tokley Perry then had the misfortune of returning to the cottage while the police were there, and in his possession were even more antiquities, which were seized. He was also carrying a journal, one of 16, which detailed the operation and implicated many of his accomplices. Over the nearly 10 years of his smuggling operation, his thefts of over 3,000 pieces of Egyptian antiquities included a 6th dynasty limestone figure, a 6-inch high devotional statue depicting a king kneeling before an altar, 12 Coptic textiles, a terracotta statue, Greco-Roman mummy masks, bronze statue of the god Horus, an unidentified royal head in granite, colored reliefs from ancient Egyptian tombs, and 35 objects from the tomb of Hetepka, including the aforementioned false doors, 3 heads of noblemen wearing a wig, and a limestone relief showing a butcher at work, 6 papyri, one in Latin, others in Greek, a limestone head of Queen Nefertiti, the wife of Ramses II. Because his smuggling crimes technically occurred in Egypt, the British authorities were unable to charge him with those crimes, and they had to settle for charging him with multiple counts of a lesser crime, handling stolen property. When discussing his smuggling spree, the unrepentant Tokley Perry claimed that his thefts were meant to preserve the pieces, not to destroy them. He said, "As long as these objects are where the power is and where the wealth is, they will be cared for." He also said that Egypt is the most dangerous place on earth for Egyptian antiquities. A piece taken out of Egypt is a piece that's saved. And he cited Lord Elgin's appropriation of the famous Greek marbles, now on display at the British Museum. Tokley Perry claimed that had he done what he had a century previously, he would have been knighted. After serving 3 years of multiple 6-year sentences, all being served concurrently, he was released. He returned to the profession of being a restorer of antiquities and is often consulted by law enforcement officials during their investigation of the illegal antiquities trade. Sounds a little bit like a con man we know. He still faces 15 years of hard labor in Egypt, having been tried and convicted in absentia. Now, as I said, Jonathan Tokley Perry was referenced in the episode, but his crime was not discussed. However, the crimes by Gerald Blanchard, or a crime by Gerald Blanchard, was specifically discussed in the episode. Some background on Gerald Blanchard is that he was born in 1972 and became hooked on stealing from the moment of his first successful heist at the age of 6. He and his single mother lived in Winnipeg, Manitoba, in Canada, and the family was so financially strapped that they couldn't even afford milk. Getting tired of eating dry cereal without milk, he stole several freshly delivered bottles of milk from a neighbor's porch. He was immediately addicted to the high he experienced from the illicit act. After his parents divorced, he and his mother moved to Nebraska, where he soon found himself in reform school. Randy Flanagan, who was one of his high school teachers, took him under his wing, hoping to direct the boy onto an honest path. Well, wasn't so successful. One thing about Blanchard was that despite severe dyslexia and a speech impediment, Blanchard, even as a toddler, could take things apart, and he proved to be an absolute genius with his hands. During his high school years, he learned construction, woodworking, model building, and automotive mechanics, studied other mechanical devices and electronics. But in spite of his seeming natural abilities and the guidance from his teacher, Blanchard was the type of kid who would spend more time trying to figure out how to cheat on a test than it would have taken him to study for the test. Soon, Blanchard had befriended department store employees in the area and had somehow managed to persuade them to steal tens of thousands of dollars of merchandise that he would then fence. His technical interests expanded into cameras and surveillance, which he used to document his targets, document his exploits, and to document the piles of money that he was acquiring. One Easter Sunday, he even managed to empty out an entire Radio Shack store. At age 16, with the help of a lawyer to handle the money and sign the deal on his behalf, he purchased a house with cash. When he moved in, he told his mother that the home belonged to a friend. But then he got busted for theft. Vouching for him, and again, hoping to direct young Gerald into the right direction, his teacher, Randy Flanagan, got Blanchard released into his own custody. In April 93, Blanchard was arrested as a suspect in a car arson. After spending several hours in the interrogation room, he was left alone. He managed to climb up through the acoustical tiles into the ceiling area. After biding his time for several hours while police officers in the station were looking for him, convinced he had somehow escaped some other way, Blanchard eventually dropped from the ceiling into a mostly empty station. Then, having stolen a police coat, badge, radio, and revolver, he left a single bullet on the desk of his interrogator. Then he rode the elevator down to the ground floor and strolled out past the front desk and out of the station. The next day, a SWAT team was sent out to recapture him, which they did. Temporarily, handcuffed and left unattended in the back of a police cruiser that had no barrier between the back and front seats, and the keys left in the ignition, Blanchard got himself out of the handcuffs and stole the police car. Blanchard was quickly recaptured and was convicted and sentenced to serve 4 years. The sentence included a deportation, and in 1997, he was released to his Canadian homeland and barred from returning to the United States for 5 years. In 1998, Blanchard undertook the audacious theft that would make his reputation, the Kochert Diamond Pearl, better known as the CC Star. The star was the last remaining piece of a 27 diamond and pearl set of hair ornaments worn by Elizabeth of Bavaria, consort of Francis Joseph I, and was on display at the Schönbrunn Palace in Vienna, Austria. Blanchard, his then wife, and her wealthy father were on a six-month grand European tour. His father-in-law's VIP status granted them special access to the Schönbrunn Palace and a special viewing of a highly prized piece from their private collection, the CC Star. The star was held on display in a large room inside an alarmed case behind bulletproof glass on a weight-sensitive pedestal. While their guide began describing the history of the piece, Blanchard was taking note of the motion sensors in the room, the types of screws on the case, the large windows in the room, and other significant details. Surreptitiously, he actually began recording every detail, the entrances, the exits, the grounds, and the alarm systems, even taking video shots of the no camera sign near the jewel case. As the private tour moved from the display room onto another room, Blanchard used a key to loosen the screws of the case, unlocked windows, and determined that if one moved slowly enough, the motion sensors would not register movement. Later, he stopped at the souvenir shop in the palace and bought a replica of the CC Star. He had noted that although there were armed guards stationed at every entrance and patrolling the halls, the roof was unguarded. Based on his research, he crafted a meticulous plan. It just so happened that skydiving was one of the myriad skills that Blanchard had picked up during his criminal career, and he knew a German pilot who was willing to fly him. Later that night, Blanchard put his plan into action. He had carefully calculated his jump, but in spite of all his planning and calculations, he overshot the roof, as was noted in the episode by Neil. And as Neil noted in the episode, he slid down the tiles of a pitched gable and only managed to save himself by grabbing onto a railing at the roof's edge. He unhooked the parachute, pulled a rope from his pack, secured it to a marble column, and then lowered himself down the side of the building. Blanchard entered through one of the windows that he had unlocked earlier. Blanchard approached the display case, moving slowly enough to ensure that the motion sensors ignored him, then removed the already loosened screws. Two long rods in the case would trigger an alarm, but a carefully placed butter knife held them in their positions. The next obstacle, of course, was the spring-loaded mechanism that the star was sitting on, which would sound an alarm if the piece were simply removed. But he had that replica, and carefully replacing the real pin with the gift store fake, he bypassed that alarm as well. After he had secured the pin, he rappelled down a back wall to the garden and then simply walked away, taking the rope and parachute with him. And as was noted in the episode, it was a full 2 weeks before anyone realized that the apparently priceless pin on display was a fake. Worse yet, no one, except Blanchard himself, had any idea about when or how the crime had taken place. Having made his reputation, although no one knew it, with the theft of the CC Star, Blanchard probably should have stopped, but he didn't. He wanted new challenges. In 2001, 3 years after the theft of the CC Star, Blanchard spotted a new branch of the Alberta Treasury Bank going up in Edmonton. He began to study the building as it was being constructed, frequently sneaking inside the building as it was taking shape. At times he went in at night, sometimes in broad daylight, disguised as a delivery person or a construction worker. Security was relaxed on the site before money showed up, which allowed Blanchard to plant surveillance devices into the space designated to be the ATM room. As a result, he knew when the cash machines were installed and what kind of locks they had. Knowing that, he ordered the same locks online and reverse engineered them so that he could later return to disassemble, disable, and remount the locks on the actual ATMs. His take from the job was a modest $60,000. But like the milk, and like the Kochert Diamond Pearl, which he knew he couldn't fence because it was too well known, it was the thrill that he sought. Blanchard targeted half dozen banks over the next few years, and always wanting to beat the system, his skills improved, and he was getting better at it. At times, he would get in through air conditioning ducts. Other times, he would pick locks, or if there were infrared sensors, he would use IR goggles to see the beams. Or he'd simply fool the sensor by blocking the beam with a lead film bag. He assembled an arsenal of tools, night vision cameras, long-range lenses, high-gain antennas that could pick up the feeds from audio and video recorders he had hidden inside of a bank, scanners programmed with encryption keys for police frequencies. And he always had a burglary kit on hand containing ropes, uniforms, cameras, and microphones. In 2002, he had also memorized the mechanics for the Mass, Hamilton, and Lagarde locks that many banks used for their ATMs. These were large, sophisticated contraptions, and later when police interrogated Blanchard, they presented him with a Mass, Hamilton lock in a dozen pieces, and he stunned them by reassembling it in 40 seconds, which apparently was unheard of. He also learned to turn himself into somebody else, a bit like Neil Caffrey. Sometimes it was just a matter of donning a yellow hard hat from a home improvement store, or it could be more involved. Eventually, Blanchard used legitimate baptism and marriage certificates filled out with his assumed names to obtain real driver's licenses. He would even take driving tests, apply for passports, or enroll in a college class under one of his many aliases. And with the help of makeup, glasses, or dyed hair, he gave each one of his aliases a different look. He had procured and stockpiled IDs and uniforms from various security companies and even law enforcement agencies. Sometimes he pretended to be a reporter so that he could hang out with celebrities. He created VIP passes and applied for press cards so that he could go to NHL playoff games or take a spin around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with racing legend Mario Andretti. He met the Prince of Monaco at a yacht race in Monte Carlo and once interviewed Christina Aguilera at one of her concerts. So he seemed to be doing quite well, but he began making mistakes. And his first mistake involved the seemingly impossible theft from the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce in Winnipeg. It was a brand new branch that was set to open for business on Monday, and Blanchard knew that the cash machines had been loaded on Friday. Blanchard had spent many previous nights infiltrating the bank. He had transmitters behind electrical outlets, pinhole cameras in thermostats, and even a cheap baby monitor behind a wall. He'd even installed handles on drywall panels so that he could remove them to enter and exit the ATM room. He'd taken detailed measurements of the room and set up a dummy version in a friend's shop to practice. He'd gotten his ATM cracking routine down to where he only needed 90 seconds after an alarm was tripped to finish and escape. On the night of the robbery, he hit 7 machines, each with 4 drawers of cash. In fact, there was so much cash that he wheeled out boxes of cash and a few money counters to help him deal with all that cash. After he had gotten them, he locked the door behind him, headed to the van that he had parked nearby, and made his escape. 8 minutes after Blanchard broke into the first ATM, the Winnipeg Police Service arrived in response to the alarm that he had tripped. He knew he was going to trip it. That's why he'd gotten his routine down so quickly. However, officers showed up. They found the front doors were locked and assumed that the alarm had been an error. With police pronouncing the bank secure, Blanchard was zipping away with more than $500,000 from his take. The following morning, everyone was confused. There were no indications of damage to the door, no fingerprints, and no surveillance recordings. Blanchard had stolen the hard drives that stored the footage from the bank's security cameras. Furthermore, Blanchard's own surveillance equipment was still transmitting from inside the ATM room, so before he skipped town, he could actually listen in on the investigators. He knew their names. He knew what their leads were. He could call both the bank manager's cell phone and the police, posing as an anonymous informant who had been involved in the heist and was swindled out of his share, thus sending the cops on wild goose chases. And his tips were made all the more credible because there was one piece of information that he had that no one else did, except the authorities. One of the bank's ATMs was left untouched, and Blanchard had done that intentionally to make it easier to sow confusion by sending in these false leads. The cops declared it the perfect crime. But then officials got a call from a vigilant employee at a nearby Walmart, which shared a large parking lot with the bank. It seems he had been annoyed by people leaving their cars there, so he took it upon himself to scan the lot every day. On the night of the break-in, he spotted a blue Dodge Caravan parked next to the bank. Seeing a dolly and other odd pieces of equipment inside it, he took down the license plate number and gave it to the police. The vehicle had been rented from Avis by one Gerald Daniel Blanchard. Just as careless, he left his fingerprints inside the van. Realizing that he had become a suspect with his carelessness, he stayed out of sight for 2 years. Now, during those 2 years, many of the investigators who had been involved with initial leads retired or were transferred, and the case eventually went cold. Until 2006, when a veteran officer and his longtime colleague decided to take a look at this one unsolved robbery. Eventually, with a great deal of research and with very little support from their higher-ups, these two officers managed to unravel a tangle of 32 false names that Blanchard had used over the years. Their preliminary checks also showed that Blanchard was a person of interest in many crimes, including the unsolved theft of the CC Star nearly 10 years earlier. They assembled roughly 275 pages of documentation, which was enough to persuade a judge to let them tap Blanchard's 18 phones. Blanchard continued making mistakes. During the second weekend that the wiretaps went live, officers heard him directing a team of underlings in a product return fraud at a Best Buy. More scams followed. They heard him wheeling and dealing in real estate. They listened in as he planned his next bank job. They learned about a vast criminal network. Then, in November of 2006, Blanchard got the fateful phone call that would ultimately lead to his demise. Blanchard had gotten involved with a criminal organization which spanned Europe and the Middle East, and whose criminal activities included counterfeiting, fraud, and credit card skimming. The organization had hacked into internet connections that companies used to process payments, and the group had then manufactured counterfeit cards, magnetized them, and embossed them with stolen numbers, and then used them to withdraw the maximum daily limits of cash from ATMs and banks before the frauds were reported. But things went sour for Blanchard. One of the men that he was responsible for disappeared, with large sums of money involved. Blanchard had to make good because the higher-ups he found himself working for were inclined to resolve their problems with violence. Blanchard needed a bank job to cover the losses. But as soon as Blanchard touched down in Vancouver with plans to hit the Bank of Nova Scotia in Chilliwack, investigators were listening in on his phone calls. When Blanchard's team arrived at the airport, cops swarmed in. On January 23rd, 2007, based on evidence seized from Blanchard's team, evidence from wiretaps, and the accumulation of the evidence that they had previously collected, more than a dozen SWAT team members swarmed Blanchard's Vancouver condo. By the time it was over, police had confiscated 10 pallets of material, over 60,000 documents, cash in various currencies, smoke bombs, firearms, and 300 electronic devices, including commercial card printers, card readers, and all manner of surveillance equipment, burglary kits, and well-organized and itemized documentation of all of Blanchard's fake identities. Oh, and the Kochert Diamond Pearl? Blanchard offered to turn the CC Star over to the police following his arrest, then led the police to his grandmother's basement in Winnipeg, where he had hidden it. Blanchard got 8 years in prison, but was released after having served 2 of those years. He tried to restyle himself as a security expert for hire, but apparently that hasn't worked out. In 2017, he was arrested for attempting to shoplift game consoles from a Canadian Best Buy location. Again, a series of crimes worthy of a Neil Caffrey, and certainly worthy of being studied along with Neil Caffrey's art forgery crime in the episode Copycat Caffrey. As you can see, there are a lot of factual details that are brought into the show, and these are just 2 of them. So a hearty well done to Channing Powell, the writer of Copycat Caffrey, for bringing in such fine and accurate detail into his story. As a reminder, you can visit the official website at www.whitecollaredpc.com, and I will, as always, be providing links to all the resources that I used in the creation of this episode, and you can also find show notes there. I want to thank you for listening, and be sure and join me for the next episode as we return to the official episodes of the series with episode 1 of season 3, On Guard. Until then, take care and God bless.